A trip through the American legal system can vary widely depending on who you are and where you are. Tanya Jacoby is studying how some subtle differences can change that journey for some people. She's a professor of law at Northwestern University, and this week was on the University of Arkansas campus to discuss her research into what she calls the hidden psychology of constitutional criminal procedure.
Women tend to, and we're talking generalizations here, and we're not talking causation in terms of whether it's nature or nurture. There's a big dispute about that. But essentially, women speak differently to men. In general, they use qualifying terms a lot, sort of, kind of, or they'll make a statement as a question instead of as a statement, or a command is more as a request rather than an imperative. And when you think about women's traditional role throughout society, rather than just, you know, the most recent decades, you know, women have been in a more precarious position, and it's important not to sort of threaten and offend men. And so they've developed patterns of speaking that are less assertive. And so this results in different patterns, and unfortunately the jurisprudence doesn't reflect that at all. We treat the defendant as essentially a man.
Because, don't let me put words in your mouth, mm-hmm. what has kind of become accepted as what is the standard mm-hmm. is how a man would react
right.
or think or talk?
Yeah, there are lots of tests that that were explicitly the reasonable man in this situation, and that later they were changed to the reasonable person, but there wasn't any really substantive shift. And so what we're proposing is that that reasonable woman in certain circumstances will be expected to behave differently from the reasonable man, and that the jurisprudence could actually take into account. I can give you an example.
Please.
So, for example, if you want to, you're being interviewed by the police, you're being interrogated, and you want a lawyer. The jurisprudence requires that you say very clearly and unambiguously, I want to speak to a lawyer. So, for example, in a case where a man actually used a sort of very female kind of register and said, oh, maybe I should talk to a lawyer.
That's not good enough.
That was not considered an invocation of the right to counsel, and the police were allowed to continue questioning him. Now, women don't generally say, give me a lawyer right now. They tend to say, perhaps, that qualifier, perhaps I should see a lawyer, almost as a question. And so that's two examples right in that one statement of the sort of qualifying language that women tend to use.
And this isn't just an interesting parlor conversation. This sets in motion how differently people interacting with the police or in the legal system can be treated, affected, eventually perhaps sentenced?
Absolutely. Every stage of the process. So when the police come up to you on the street to talk to you, whether you feel that you can leave or cannot leave, which will determine whether you're being seized by the police or not, that will be affected because that perception changes. If the police say to you, can I search you? And a woman says, if you must, for example, that could be consent to the search. Whereas, what they might really be saying is, I really don't want you to, but this is how much I feel I can assert myself. Whether it's considered that you were being interrogated by the police officer, that can change. As I said, you know, whether you've asked for your right to counsel. So at every stage of the process, it's harder for a woman to receive the full group of rights that it's easier for men to achieve.
There have been studies that show that women are far less likely to feel they can leave an engagement with a police officer, not succumb to a search, than men.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, again, generalizations, mm-hmm. we're all different, but women are far less likely.
Right, that's right. And now it may be the case that this will change over time. As women become more equal within society and women being assertive becomes more acceptable, these patterns may diminish over time. But at the moment, they're still fairly strong.
So what can be done on the flip side to understand this and make it that it's not just how a reasonable man would react? I mean, things a little bit fairer?
Our proposal is that elements such as gender that have been well established by social science as to result in these systematic differences could be taken into account. So whether a person is able to say, maybe I should speak to a lawyer instead of I demand a lawyer, whether something is considered overly ambiguous and therefore not an invocation of the right to counsel could take into a consideration gender. And it's not just gender they could take into consideration. That's our main illustration. But there are other recognized categories and sometimes recognized categories by the courts. For example, whether you're a juvenile. So the court has in many cases recognized that juveniles perceive and express themselves differently, but only in certain doctrines and not in others. And it's very much ad hoc as to which doctrines the court recognizes this in. So there is precedent for the court doing it, for taking into account a characteristic that we know makes a difference in terms of the assertion of one's rights, the perception of being seized. And it applies it to juveniles, but only in some circumstances. And so we're saying the same thing should happen with gender. It should happen with juvenile status more across the board. We also talk about mental disability and how that has similar effects. And so there are various categories. And we don't talk in detail about this because others have, but race would also be another factor.
This extends right into Miranda rights.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how they're read or how – is this an opportunity – for us to re-examine, what, a 40-year-old?
50-year-old.
50-year-old.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of whether the Miranda right warning is effective, you mean? I mean, there is certainly a very lively jurisprudence on that as well. And there is a lot of relevant social science evidence as to whether those warnings are effective. There's not been evidence, there's not been inquiry into whether they're more or less effective on women versus men, but there is a lot of evidence that they're not all that effective. It's hard to measure that directly, but there are a number of social science studies. So, for example, you know, the waiver rate of rights is 80-90%. Now, that doesn't mean they're not working. People could make a rational choice that it's in their interests to waive their rights. But we do know that the poor are more likely to waive those rights, for instance. And people less experienced with the criminal justice system are more likely to waive those rights. And so there definitely are categorical differences in terms of who is better at asserting their rights than others.
Are you aware of any studies that have been done about how authorities, if they talk, react differently to men or women?
The police officer,
yes,
whether they express themselves differently. I would imagine there is work on that. I don't know off the top of my head anything that I can think of in that.
You mentioned proposals to address this hidden psychology. Any progress? Any sort of advancement there?
Well, I mean, I'm giving talks around the place, and people are listening. And I recently gave this talk to some public defenders down in Illinois, and they seemed quite keen on the idea. But you know, these changes take time.
Are you optimistic that this can make progress?
I'm hopeful.
I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Tanya Jacoby is a professor of law at Northwestern University and was a visiting scholar at the University of Arkansas School of Law this week. This is Ozarks at Large.